let us look closely at this new person seated in authority over Spain, and at his council. For from such men as he, and from the districts they ruled, the nations of our time, and their royal families, were to spring. The first thing that would be noticed on entering the presence of this person who governed Spain would be that he still had all the insignia and manner of Roman government. He sat upon a formal throne, as the emperor's delegate had sat. The provincial delegate of the emperor. On official occasions, he would wear the official Roman garments. The orb and the scepter were already his symbols, we may presume, as they had been those of the emperor and the emperor's local subordinates before him. But in two points, this central official differed from the old local governor whom he exactly succeeded, and upon whose machinery of taxation he relied for power. These two points were, first, that he was surrounded by a very powerful and somewhat jealous body of great men. Second, that he did not habitually give himself an imperial Roman title, but was called Rex. Let us consider these points separately. As to the first point, the emperor in Byzantium, and before that in Rome or at Ravenna, worked, as even absolute power must work, through a multitude of men. He was surrounded by high dignitaries, and there devolved from him a whole hierarchy of officials, with the most important of whom he continually consulted. But the emperor had not been officially and regularly bound in with such a council. His formulae of administration were personal formulae. Now and then he mentioned his great officials, but he only mentioned them if he chose. This new local person, who had been very gradually and almost unconsciously substituted for the old Roman governors, the Rex, was, on the contrary, a part of his own council, and all his formulae of administration mentioned the council as his coadjutors and assessors in administration. This was necessary above all, a most important point, in anything that regarded the public funds. It must not be imagined for a moment that the Rex issued laws or edicts, or, what was much more common and much more vital, levied taxation under the dominion of, or subject to the consent of, these great men about him. On the contrary, he spoke as absolutely as ever the imperial governors had done in the past, and indeed he could not do otherwise, because the whole machinery he had inherited presupposed absolute power. But some things were already said to be done with these great men, and it is of capital importance that we should note this word, with. The phrases of the official documents from that time run more and more in one of half a dozen regular formulae, all of which are based upon this idea of the council, and are in general such words as these. So-and-so, Rex, ordered and commanded, with his chief men, that so-and-so, ... should be done. As to the second point, we note the change of title. The authority of the Palatium is a Rex, not a legate, nor a governor, nor a man sent from the emperor, nor a man directly and necessarily nominated by him, but a Rex. Now, what is the meaning of that word, Rex? It is usually translated by our word, king. But it does not here mean anything like what our word king means when we apply it today, or as we have applied it for many centuries. It does not mean the ruler of a large independent territory. It means a combination of two things when it is used to name these local rulers in the later Roman Empire. It means, one, the chieftain of an auxiliary group of soldiers, who holds an imperial commission. And it means, too, that man acting as a local governor. Centuries and centuries before, Indeed, 1,000 years before, the word Rex had meant the chieftain of the little town and petty surrounding district of Rome, or of some similar neighboring and small state. It had, in the Latin language, always retained some such connotation. The word Rex was often used in Latin literature as we use the word king in English, i.e., to describe the head of a state, great or small. But as applied to the local rulers of the 5th century in Western Europe, it was not so used. It meant, as I have said, chieftain or chief officer of auxiliaries. A rex was not then, in Spain or in Gaul, a king in our modern sense of the word. He was only the military head of a particular armed force. He was originally the commander, hereditary or chosen or nominated by the emperor, of an auxiliary force serving as part of the Roman army. Later, when these troops, originally recruited perhaps from some one barbaric district, changed by slow degrees into a body half police, half noble, their original name would extend to the whole local army. The rex of, say, Batavian auxiliaries, the commander of the Batavian corps, would probably be a man of Batavian blood, with hereditary position, and would be called Rex Bataviorum. Afterwards, when the recruiting was mixed, he still kept that title, and later still, when the Batavii as such had disappeared, his fixed title would remain. There was no similarity possible between the word Rex and the word Imperator, any more than there is between the words Miners' Union or Trade Conference and the word England. There was, of course, no sort of equality. A Roman general in the early part of the process planning a battle would think of a rex as we think of a divisionary general. He might say, "I shall put my regulars here in the center, my auxiliaries, Huns or Goths or Franks or what not, I shall put here. Send for the rex, and I will give him his orders." A rex, in this sense, was a subject, and often an unimportant subject, of the imperator, or emperor. The imperator being, as we remember, the commander-in-chief of the Roman army, upon which institution the Roman state or empire or civilization had depended for so many centuries. When the Roman army began to add to itself auxiliary troops, drilled, of course, after the Roman fashion, and forming one body with the Roman forces, but contracted for in bulk, as it were, the chieftains of these barbaric and often small bodies were called, in the official language, reges. Thus, Alaric, a Roman officer and nothing more, was the rex of his officially appointed auxiliary force. And since the nucleus of that force had once been a small body of Goths, and since Alaric held his position as an officer of that auxiliary force because he had once been, by inheritance, a chieftain of the Goths, the word rex was attached to his imperial commission in the Roman army, and there was added to it the name of that particular barbaric tribe with which his command had originally been connected. He was a rex of the Roman auxiliary troops called Goths. The rex in Spain was Rex Gatorum, not Rex Hispaniae. That was altogether a later idea. The rex in northern France was not Rex Galliae. He was Rex Francorum. In each case, he was the rex of the particular auxiliary troop from which his ancestors, sometimes generations before, had originally drawn their imperial commission and their right to be officers in the Roman army. Thus you will have the Rex Francorum, or King of the Franks, so styled in the Palatium at Paris as late as, say, 700 AD. Not because any body of Franks still survived as a separate corps. They had been but a couple of regiments or so, 200 years before, and had since disappeared. But because the original title had derived from a Roman auxiliary force of Franks. Footnote. We have documentary record. The greater part of the Frankish auxiliaries under Clovis were baptized with their general. They came to 4,000 men. In other words, the old Roman local legislative and taxing power, the reality of which lay in the old surviving Roman machinery of a hierarchy of officials, with their titles, writs, etc., was vested in the hands of a man called Rex, that is, commander, of such and such an auxiliary force, commander of the Franks, for instance, or commander of the Goths. He still commanded, in the year 550, a not very large military force on which local government depended. And in this little army, the barbarians were still probably predominant, because, as we have seen, towards the end of the empire, the stuff of the army had become barbaric, and the armed force was mainly of barbaric recruitment. But that small military force was also, and as certainly, very mixed indeed. Many a slave or broken Roman freedman would enlist, for it had privileges and advantages of great value. Footnote. Hence the leges, or codes, specially regulating the status of these Roman troops, and called in documents the laws of the Goths, or Burgundians, as the case may be. There is a trace of old barbaric customs in some of these, sometimes of an exclusive rule of marriage, but the mass of them are obviously Roman privileges. No one cared in the least whether the members of an armed force, the armed forces which sustained society, were Roman, Gallic, Italian, or German in racial origin. They were of all races and origins. Very shortly after, by say 600 at latest, the army had become a universal rough levy of all sorts and kinds, and the restriction of race was forgotten, save in a few customs still clinging by hereditary right to certain families, and called their laws. Again, there was no conception of rebellion against the empire in the mind of Regs. All these reges, without exception, held their military office and power originally by a commission from the empire. All of them derived their authority from men who had been regularly established as imperial functionaries. When the central power of the emperor had, as a fact, broken down, the regs, as a fact, administered the whole machinery without control. But no regs ever tried to emancipate himself from the empire, or warred for independence against the emperor. The regs, the local man, undertook all government, simply because the old government above him, the central government, had failed. No regs ever called himself a local imperator, or dreamed of calling himself so. And that is the most significant thing in all the transition between the full civilization of the old empire and the Dark Ages. The original Roman armies invading Gaul, Spain, the Western Germanies, and Hungary fought to conquer, to absorb, to be masters of and makers of the land they seized. No local governments of the later transition, no regs of Vandal, Goth, Hun, Frank, or Berber, or Moor troop, ever dreamt of such a thing. He might fight another local regs to get part of his taxing power or his treasure. He might take part in the great religious quarrels, as in Africa, and act tyrannically against a dissident majority. But to fight against the empire as such, or to attempt conquest and rule over a subject population, would have meant nothing to him. In theory, the empire was still under one control. There, then, you have the picture of what held the levers of the machine of government during the period of its degradation and transformation, which followed the breakdown of central authority. Clovis, in the north of France, the Burgundian chieftain at Arles, Theodoric in Italy, Athanagild later at Toledo in Spain, were all of them men who had stepped into the shoes of an unbroken local Roman administration, who worked entirely by it, and whose machinery of administration, wherever they went, was called by the Roman and official name of Palatium. Their families were originally of barbaric stock. They had for their small armed forces a military institution descended and derived from the Roman auxiliary forces. Often, especially in the early years of their power, they spoke a mixed and partly barbaric tongue. Footnote: the barbaric dialects outside the empire were already largely Latinized through commerce with the empire and by its influence. And of course, what we call Teutonic languages are in reality half-Roman, long before we get our first full documents in the 8th and 9th centuries. More easily than pure Latin. But every one of them was a soldier of the declining empire, and regarded himself as a part of it, not even as conceivably an enemy of it. When we appreciate this, we can understand how insignificant were those changes of frontier, which make so great a show in historical atlases. The regs of such and such an auxiliary force dies and divides his kingdom between two sons. What does that mean? Not that a nation with its customs and its whole form of administration was suddenly divided into two. Still less that there has been what we call today annexation or partition of states. It simply means that the honor and advantage of administration are divided between the two heirs, who take the one area, the other, over which to gather taxes and receive personal profit. It must always be remembered that the personal privilege so received was very small in comparison with the total revenue to be administrated, and that the vast mass of public work, as carried on by the judiciary, the officers of the treasury, and so forth, continued to be quite impersonal and fundamentally imperial. This governmental world of clerks and civil servants lived its own life, and was only in theory dependent upon the regs. And the rex was no more than the successor of the chief local Roman official. Footnote: our popular historical atlases render a very bad service to education by their way of coloring these districts as though they were separate modern nations. The real division, right up to full tide of feudalism, was Christian and pagan, and within the former, Eastern and Western, Greek and Latin. The Rex, by the way, called himself always by some definite inferior Roman title, such as Vir Illustre, as an Englishman today might be called Sir Charles So-and-so, or Lord So-and-so, never anything more. And often, as in the case of Clovis, he not only accepted directly from the Roman emperor a particular office, but observed the old popular Roman customs, such as largesse and procession, upon his induction into that office. Now, why did not this man, this Rex, in Italy or Gaul or Spain, simply remain in the position of local Roman governor? One would imagine, if one did not know more about that society, that he should have done this. The small auxiliary forces of which he had been chieftain rapidly merged into the body of the empire, as had the infinitely larger mass of slaves and colonists, equally barbarian in origin, for century after century before that time. The body of civilization was one, and we wonder at first why its moral unity did not continue to be represented by a central monarch. Though the civilization continued to decline, its form should, one would think, have remained unchanged, and the theoretic attachment of each of these subordinates to the Roman emperor at Constantinople should have endured indefinitely. As a fact, the memory of the old central authority of the emperor was gradually forgotten. The Rex in his local government, as he got weaker, also got more isolated. he came to coining his own money, to treating directly as a completely independent ruler. At last, the ideas of kings and kingdoms took shape in men's minds. Why? End of part 1 of chapter 4.